community, and the planet.
Good evening, and thanks for tuning in to Eco Radio KC. On tonight's program, we share audio from a panel discussion on water in Kansas that took place at the Sustainability Actions Network's annual meeting in Lawrence, Kansas on Friday. But first, Mike Murphy here with some of your headlines. EcoWatch is reporting that despite protests from conservationists, local tribe leaders, Democratic lawmakers, and even the United Nations expert on indigenous rights, at 6 a.m. on Friday, the Trump administration will allow citizens and companies to start staking claims on sections of the Bears, Ears, and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monuments in Utah so the new stakeholders can conduct hard rock mining on the formerly protected lands. The process for staking a claim remains much as it did during the gold rush, Reuters reported. A prospector hammers four poles into the ground corresponding to the four points of a parcel that can be as big as 20 acres, attaches a written description of the claim onto one of them. A prospector then has 30 days to record the claim at the local Bureau of Land Management office. The cost of claims are low, a $212 filing fee, an annual maintenance fee of 150 laws. Unlike laws governing petroleum extraction, there are no environmental guidelines specific to hard rock mining and no requirements to pay a royalty. The claims provide prospectors mineral rights but not ownership of the land. And then Reuters is reporting that clumps of oil have washed up on the shores of southern Japan, and there are fears they may be leaking from an Iranian crude tanker that sank in the world's worst disaster in decades, the Japanese Coast Guard said on Friday. Black clumps have reached the shores of the island of Amami Oshima, a Coast Guard official told Reuters by phone. Authorities are checking to see if it is from the Sanchi tanker that sank in the East China Sea last month after being alerted to its presence by the public. Anami Oshima is part of a chain of islands that includes Okinawa, an area famous for pristine beaches and reef systems. The Iranian tanker sank nearly 3 weeks ago, raising worries about damage to the marine ecosystem. Japan's environmental ministry had said that last month it saw little chance that the spill would reach Japanese shores. And that's about all we're going to report on tonight because we've got a lot to bring you. On Friday night, the Sustainability Action Network held its annual meeting. And as part of that meeting, they had a panel on protecting water in Kansas. This was held at the Douglas County Fairgrounds. And so we're going to jump right into this. I think the first voice you're going to hear is that of Aaron Kirkendall, who is the moderator. So do give a listen.
We are going to start the panel discussion. We have, I think, the best group of water activists in the state of Kansas. You're going to hear a lot of really fascinating perspectives. They're going to work to define problems, and to the degree we know how to solve them, solutions. And part of the reason we're doing this is so we can start building an action plan that'll get all of you, anybody that wants to be involved in helping to solve them. It can be done. It just takes the will and some planning and some brains and some people. So think about that as you're listening. Even if you can put in 1 hour a month, it can make a big difference. You're going to hear about legislative problems, water pollution problems, a whole host of things. Different folks might want to get involved in different areas, and we hope you will. Later, we're going to do a panel discussion, then we're going to do a Q&A. Some of you have already... during this thing, write your questions down on these stickies as you listen to people, and either bring them up and stick them on a board, or when we get to Q&A, come up and talk on the mic, however you want to do it. And following that, we're gonna push some tables together, break into kind of subject area groups, and work on problems. So you'll be able to pick whatever area you want to work in. Think about that, too, as we talk. So I am going to turn the mic over to Craig Vollant, who's been working water problems for a very long time.
Thank you, Eric. My name is Craig Vollant. I'm with the Kansas Chapter Sierra Club, and I'm the chair of the Agriculture Committee. And I've been asked to talk about the impact of animal factories, or also called concentrated animal feeding operations, on water quality in Kansas and elsewhere. Kansas has the second largest, possibly the largest, concentrated animal feeding operation in Greeley County, with over 200,000 pigs in about two sections of land. And it's very common elsewhere in this state and others, where they have concentrated tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of animals, not only pigs but chickens and cattle. And of course, when you concentrate that many animals in one place, you are concentrating their waste in that one place. So our fearless leaders were challenged then, when this ridiculous technology was invented about 40 years ago. Well, what are we going to do with all this manure? Well, they created some legal fictions to regulate it. One is that you can just dig a hole in the ground and pour it in there, pour all the waste in this thing, which are called waste impoundments or lagoons, and it will not pollute the groundwater, at least not in the next 10 or 20 years. And the second, more damaging fiction that is the basis of all regulation of CAFOs all over the country, is that if you develop what is called a nutrient management plan, just a plan by the operator of whatever it is, hog farm or cattle feedlot or whatever, as long as he or she has a plan, then there's not going to be any runoff in the surface water. If there is runoff in the surface water, perhaps because they put wastewater when it was frozen ground or something, then that's defined as agricultural runoff, of which the CAFO is not responsible. Well, everybody knows that you cannot adequately enforce the fact that there's never runoff when billions of wastewater are applied on cropland. The theory is that you're going to use this wonderful resource to grow crops. Well, what happens if the ground over time, which is the case in western Kansas, becomes more and more saline, so that the yields for the corn or sorghum or whatever gets less and less? Then you don't, if the crop doesn't grow to the yield that was predicted in your nutrient management plan, then of course you've got too much nitrogen and phosphorus that eventually, the further east we come in this state, but in the western or in the eastern part of the United States, it's very common that this wastewater runs off into our streams and also causes groundwater pollution. So that's the problem. So what's the solution? Unfortunately, Big Ag, which is the people behind all these CAFOs all over the country, are extremely politically powerful. It comes down to basically this: two senators in every state. This means that there will never really be a solution through the Congress of the United States, because we have, you know who our senators are going to stop it. So that means that really the next step for us to get rid of the threat of CAFOs to our water supply is in state law and resistance at the state level. And even more importantly, and this is what I spend a lot of my time on, is we take their market away eventually by the way you eat, the way you encourage your family to eat. You should never, ever eat meat out of a grocery store. There are lots of farmers now that produce free-range, much more sustainable animal products, or you can just eat less meat or no meat. But the one way to stop these guys is to never, ever, at any restaurant or any of the fast food where a lot of it's distributed, the McDonald's of the world and all these people, that's where they sell all this factory meat, which is not only poor tasting, often contaminated. So that's how we defeat them.
All right.
Thank you, Craig. Write your questions down or be prepared to talk about them in a few minutes. And Dawn Bueller is up next.
Thank you. Good evening. My name is Dawn Bueller. I'm the Kansas Riverkeeper with Friends of the Caw. Can I get a raise of hands? How many of you have heard of us? Yay. Yeah, nice. That's a great number. I like seeing that number. So we represent, we're the only nonprofit that works exclusively on the Kansas River. It's a 173-mile long river that runs from Junction City to Kansas City, Kansas, where it meets the Missouri River. So we all live in a watershed, right? So if you know what a watershed, it's an area where everything drains to a single point. So in the case of the Kansas River, our watershed is 53,000 square miles. It's almost the entire upper half of Kansas, with the exception of the upper corner up around Atchison. It drains to the Missouri River. But it covers almost that entire upper half of Kansas, plus a huge portion of central Nebraska and eastern Colorado. So when we're talking about the Kansas River watershed and what happens to it, we're talking about this entire area. If you could imagine for a second all of the pollution that's occurring on 53,000 square miles, and then if we don't use that water or divert it for some other purpose, it makes its way into the Kansas River. So we have come up this year with our top five water quality issues on the Kansas River. I have a form that looks like this, a little flyer. There's a bunch of them on the table back there if you'd like to grab one. So our top five issues that we deal with on the Kansas River, the first two are tied together. Number one is nutrient pollution, and number two is sedimentation. So those two issues are kind of together, because when sediment moves, the nutrients will move with it. So we'll find nitrogen and phosphorus in the Kansas River, and the Kansas River is impaired for phosphorus. Solutions to that. So I'm going to go through these five and offer what we think some solutions are. We're advocating for water funding. First of all, we need to fund the water plan, the $8 million that hasn't gone into the water plan for about the last 8 years. That transfer needs to happen. That's number one. Number two, there is a Blue Ribbon Task Force that the governor put together last year that recommended a 0.1 cent sales tax for these projects to improve water quality and water quantity. We're trying to get a grassroots effort started for that as well. I'm the coordinator for the Lower Kansas RAPS program. That's a water restoration and protection strategy program that is through the Kansas Department of Health and Environment, and it's using EPA 319 money. So we are also advocating, even at the federal level, for the EPA 319 program to be funded, and it has been threatened by the Trump administration. That program is a great program. In Kansas, you know, everything's voluntary. There's no mandatory conservation practices on our land. So this is a voluntary program where we use cost share dollars and we give them to landowners to install conservation practices that improve water quality. So that's where the funding needs to be targeted. I'm on the Regional Advisory Committee for the Water Vision, and our Regional Advisory Committee is also pushing for these issues. Number three on our list, of course, is sand dredging. It's still a problem on the Kansas River. We are still dredging sand. The Corps of Engineers did a final environmental impact statement, came out in the fall. They have added new dredge sites. We heavily wrote letters against it. Those new dredge sites, one of them, frankly, is between DeSoto and Cedar Creek, which is a very popular area for Cub Scouts and Girl Scouts and youth, because it's the only 5 mile section on the river. The other section that they're wanting to open up is above Topeka, and we have concerns about that as well, because the Topeka Weir, it's Topeka's only source of water supply, is the surface water of the Kansas River. So we have concerns about that as well. The Corps is scheduled to give us a record of decision any time now, so we're waiting to hear on that. Number four is biotic integrity, which is harmful algal blooms at Milford. we're working on. That again goes back to that funding at the state level. And the last one that we have an issue with is environmental flows of the river. And we have partnered with the Nature Conservancy on a project that they are doing with the Corps of Engineers called the Sustainable Rivers Program that will work to kind of even out those flows on the Kansas River so that we have more water in the river for the environment.
Thank you, Don.
Well, much thanks to Sane for gathering us together here and listening to one another. I want to kind of start on the back and then go to the front. I want to say a little bit about the areas that we are addressing as Water Advocacy Team, or WAT, the acronym. Then I'm going to say a little bit about how we are going to go about the solutions, with a few of the solutions. And if I have time, which really is important for this group, is how did this come about? What's the origin of what, I think, really informs about what we're doing? We basically now have identified, and we've identified it. We've had three large meetings with two smaller ones. Now we don't have a membership. We simply have a list of people who want to be contacted, over 250 at this point, because we have had met on the issue of the injection wells and, of course, the horrible situation in Baldwin City and then down in the Flint Hills. We've also been able to do a presentation with Don Stull as far as response to the Tyson situation. And most recently, we had Tom Stiles come in and talk about the Kansas River water quality. But the areas that we're focusing on is, number one, is the Douglas County 2020 Comprehensive Plan. The need to address the amendments that are being made for that, and to be very assertive in terms of clarifying them and making them more clear for them and also for the general public, and particularly concerning water, but other areas as well. We also are going to be having a focus group on the Kansas Corporation Commission, which has been uncovered for its unbelievable inability to be open and its need for reform that will take legislative action, including the discovery now we have more earthquakes as well as the injection wells and fracking. We also are going to just simply have a larger area called water depletion. How do we decrease and help the depletion rate slow down from the aquifers from which we get most of our water for Kansas, as well, though, for the Kansas River, and which gets into the Kansas River. And then water quality is another area that we're looking at, and you've already mentioned it, but not only, it's really going beyond nitrates. There's some more important issues than that, which are important in nitrates, but also what are the happenings with all the drugs that are there and other things that affect us and others. And then finally, the 2018 Farm Bill. We're also going to address that. I want to back up and say a little bit about how we're going to come to the solutions. We're going to be having a meeting February 21st. If you want to be on that list to be announced, we have an email list back there. We're taking people, names, et cetera. We're going to be, after all these other meetings, we're going to be asking people to get into base groups surrounding these particular areas. If another one emerges, fine. But we're going to ask them to do that, and we're going to have a facilitator that's trained. We're also going to have a question asked to get experts in the areas and resource persons in each of these areas, and then decide on a plan of action that may take 1, 2, 3 years, and ask people to commit themselves, maybe not to every meeting, but at least clarifying that so that we can address it in a sustainable way. These issues are long-term, and they're not going to go away unless we do that. The other thing that we were asked to do was to speak before the Interim Committee on Water and Natural Environment. Natural resources, which is one of the first things I did was raise a question, which is a cultural issue, is calling water a resource. It's much more than a resource. And so we addressed that at that meeting, and that really came out of some other prior things from whence we came, and which I can speak to maybe a little bit more lately of why we even evolved to that point. Thank you very much.
Okay, I have a speech. Kansas Water began in the fall of 2017 as the Quail Oil Well in Morris County along the Nemaha Uplift and the Humboldt Fault Line in the Arbuckle Shale gained media attention, and I began to do my own research not only about the dangers of that particular well, but the entire body of regulations surrounding the oil and gas industry in Kansas. What began as a desire to stop one well in which I could not find scientific justification to permit became a realization that the current structure of the Kansas Corporation Commission statutes surrounding the oil and gas industry do not seem to fulfill their mission to, quote, serve the people of Kansas by regulating the state's energy infrastructure, oil and gas production, and commercial trucking to ensure public safety, end quote. Not only are the regulations seemingly not written with citizen safety in mind, for instance, KAR 82-3-1402 and 1403, which allow non-disclosure of the chemical constituents from the wastewater from oil and gas, unless there is a public health emergency surrounding a spill. Even then, healthcare workers must sign a non-disclosure agreement in order to treat their patients. Additionally, the well operators have 2 business days to respond to any requests for the chemical constituents in the wastewater. I do not feel protected by these regulations, and I cannot help but see that they benefit the oil and gas industry above our state citizens. Put simply, the public has a right to know what is being injected into their land and possibly water, especially if public health and welfare is in question. Coupled with the lack of citizen-centered policy, the regulations are also not followed by the oil and gas industry or enforced by the KCC. An example and evidence of this can be found in the excessive number of abandoned wells in our state. In 1996, the Kansas legislature supplied monies to the KCC to begin plugging abandoned oil and gas wells in our state. And every year since that time, the KCC has monitored the quantity, locations, and severity of these abandoned wells. Since 1996, when tasked with plugging these wells, the number has increased from approximately 9,000 abandoned wells to over 21,000. Our tax dollars via approximately $2 million fund that gets reappropriated each year should be taking care of at least the largest parts of this problem. And yet, between 2016 and 2018, only one of the Priority 1 Level A wells, Level A being a well actively causing harm to groundwater, surface water, or public safety, has been plugged, with 5 wells that are actively harming groundwater, surface water, or public safety haven't had any work done on them. Not only do we need to worry about what is in our water, but the oil and gas industry uses an inordinate amount of water. From 2015 data, Kansas produces approximately 1% of the United States oil and gas. However, it has over 10% of the nation's Class II underground injection control wells. We are generating wastewater on at least a 10-to-1 ratio with this statistic. The wells, though, may not capture all the water used, and Kansas has been documented as using as up to 3 times the amount of water as other states, producing 22 barrels of water for every barrel of oil, which is a very inefficient use of a finite resource. In 2010, Kansas used up to 50 million gallons of fresh water for mining operations daily. Having clean water to drink is vital to life, but if we want to talk money, it is the backbone of the highest grossing and widest reaching industry in Kansas. Agriculture has a higher gross domestic product than oil and gas industry, 1% for oil and gas, and up to 19% for farming. Thus, diverting water resources, holdings, permits, use away from an industry that contributes less to our GDP and back to a higher grossing one would be a boon to the people and economy of Kansas. It took 10 years of our nation's Environmental Protection Agency gathering data, the study being shut down, and a bunch of federal and state back and forth regulatory garbage, but there is now proof. Federally funded proof, current oil and gas industry practices contaminate drinking water. We as Kansans can either allow our state to become as earthquake-prone as Oklahoma, having salty non-potable water like Kentucky, having flammable water come out of our taps like Pennsylvania and Ohio, or facing water shortages of the western states. I would like to advocate that we Kansans want the oil and gas industry regulations to implement the idea of irreversible harm, not imminent harm. We do not want a reactive approach to the contamination of our water resources. We want a proactive approach. Right now, if the public can't, beyond a shadow of a doubt, say that well X will fail on any Y day, the wells are allowed to proceed. And we're already stuck cleaning up the 21,000 wells that already pose a problem. Do we want more? We the people cannot and will not allow our health to be at the mercy of a host of chemical unknowns. These wells will fail. They are man-made structures, and the consequences affecting our infrastructure, resources, and health are too great to allow this practice to continue. As far as solutions, contact your legislators. There's a group of people that are writing letters to the KCC. We could do that today as a group if you guys would want to. There's one in Cheyenne Bottoms. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. It's kind of out in western Kansas, but it's a wildlife refuge, basically, with hundreds of thousands of migratory birds that come there every year, and there's a well going in like 10 miles away from it, so that's pretty bad news. And that's actually the protest period will end on the 16th of February, so fun, fun.
Hello and good evening. Yeah, okay, all right, all right. Good evening, okay, all right. My name is Rachel, and I run a community revitalization organization in Wyandotte County. I'm also co-host of the Hip Hop Environmental Report. Just by a show of hands, how many of you are aware of what a combined sewer system is? Okay, all right. All right, well, I'll give a little bit of background. You know, it's an issue that many cities all over the nation are tackling. Both Kansas City, Missouri and Kansas City, Kansas have planned for major infrastructure upgrades over the next 10 to 20 years to mitigate the environmental pollution that occurs from a combined sewer system. So a combined sewer system conveys both stormwater and sanitary sewage through a single pipe to a wastewater treatment facility. However, during periods of heavy rainfall, the sewer system can overflow into basements, onto the street, or most commonly into local water sources, which in the case of Kansas City, Kansas, is the Kansas and or Missouri rivers. These overflows contain untreated domestic, industrial, and commercial waste and can pose threat to public health, aquatic species, and aquatic habitats. Since 2004, the Unified Government of Kansas City, Kansas has reported at least 450 such overflows, resulting in the discharge of raw sewage into the Kansas and Missouri rivers. So, in 2013, the EPA agreed to a settlement with the Unified Government to adopt an integrated overflow control plan to investigate and repair existing sewer infrastructure across the county, including upgrading monitoring technology, reducing rainwater that gets into the combined sewers, and rehabilitating sewer pipes. That's one issue. The other issue is that the challenge to the community in the recommended plan is projected to cost $200 million over the next 10 years. So therefore, the proposal also includes a rate increase equivalent of 1.9% of the median household income, which is approximately $38,000 over the next 10 years. So many cities, including KCK, have incomes that are less than that median. And this results in more households being adversely impacted by the increasing wastewater bills if the income distribution is unevenly distributed towards the lower levels of income. And that's the case for KCK. So to fund these overflow controls will require that wastewater bills grow faster than household incomes and the general rate of inflation for several more decades, resulting in even greater affordability challenges, particularly for lower income households, mostly households on the eastern side of the county, which already face large amounts of environmental injustice as is. And so the majority of low-income residents in WICO live within that area, and it also has the oldest wastewater infrastructure. So there are significant challenges in being able to increase the rates for an extended period of time. And my challenge is I don't profess to have any solutions. I also don't profess to be a water quality expert. My challenge is how to protect those who already bear the largest burden of environmental justice from skyrocketing utility bills while also making these critical improvements to our wastewater processes to prevent further pollution to our natural resources. That's it.
Thank you, Rachel.
Hi. I would like to address and really actually echo a few things that Thad and Jessica have already brought up. My main concerns are water contamination and just water security. And if I have time, I would like to address a little bit what the National Sierra Club is doing with their Water Centennials grassroots network team. I lived in Northern California during a drought, and all the public restrooms said, make every drop count. And so when I see that fracking uses 5 million gallons of water per well. That's an insane amount of drops of water to be taken out of the cycle. And I can't even count to 5 million, but as a visual, that's 7 Olympic-sized swimming pools, if that helps to visualize that. The water, when it comes back up, is contaminated, probably beyond cleaning, because it brings up the radioactivity. And how do you get rid of the radioactivity in the water? With the saltwater injection wells, it's like, okay, just dumping it back into the ground with the potential to contaminate groundwater, wells, and I just read potentially using it as irrigation water. That's just completely insane. What the local Sierra Club group, the Wakarusa group here in Lawrence, has tried to do is at least educate on this topic of the fracking and the oil and gas industry coming to Douglas County, where they've actually been already. With the Water Action Group, we had the Here, There, Everywhere forum across the parking lot in November. And there are alternative forms of energy. We do not need the gas and natural oil, but there is no alternative to water. I just bought a bumper sticker, and I keep meaning to put it on my car, but I keep using it to hold up at things. First of all, there is no alternative to water. I'm completely horrified that Cape Town in South Africa is almost to day zero on their water. They're going to run out of water. Then what? There are riots in Iran, water riots, because there's no water for drinking. There, on the chapter level, there is going to be some pushes for legislation for testing water and other issues there. The other thing that I'd like to very briefly talk about, and I do not have my handy-dandy beautiful illustrative slide, is water and food security issues. My great visual here shows that to produce 4 ounces of beef takes 461.78 gallons of water, compared to 4 ounces of vegetables, which takes 9.64 gallons of water. So that's sort of the, you know, and then nuts, cheese, pork, chicken, beans, lentils, eggs, milk, and fruit are, you know, on the continuum between those two extremes. Reducing meat consumption is, I think I can echo Craig on this. We're trying to do a little bit of a experimental thing with hosting plant-based potlucks, which the idea of going without meat and dairy is alarming to people. But given my fabulous chart, which you cannot see, I think it's important to sort of throw that out into the conversation. Do I have time to talk a little bit about the water sentinels or not?
Yes.
Elaine Giesel, who could not be here tonight, is actually on the national committee, the National Grassworks team. Their mission is to protect and fully implement the Clean Water Act, to advocate for access to clean and affordable drinking water, to advocate for responsible ecological management of our surface and groundwaters, to advocate for clean water and hold polluters accountable, to connect people with their waterways by conducting local water quality testing and monitoring, to expose and oppose activities that damage the integrity of our nation's water, to inform and educate the public and influence decision makers, And then lastly, to engage in grassroots activism for sound local and national water policies. The Sierra Club's mantra is explore, enjoy, and protect the planet. I initially joined because I wanted to have people to hike with, and so to enjoy and explore the planet. But I've kind of gotten stuck on the protect the planet because it just seems like it's such a dire thing that we need to address on so many levels.
That's it.
Thank you very much. I learned a lot. I hope everybody did. We're going to move into our next section, which is a little Q&A and discussion. So we've got kind of a mix of some questions that are on slips, and we're going to open up the floor to others as well. But I'll get the ones that came up here first, since they were first in line. For Dawn, which business government entities make up most of the demand for the dredging? And it's a little bigger. There's a second. What does a dredge site look like, and what does it do to surrounding areas? Why is it bad exactly?
Okay. So the biggest use of dredging commercial sand is for our roads and for concrete. So that's a lot of use. One of the problems is that for the Kansas River specifically, there's an issue with the proximity to the urban area. So Kansas City, specifically Johnson County, with all of its growth, they have to, or I guess economically, they think they have to truck it within a certain distance from the construction site. So that's why we see so much dredging on the upper end of the Kansas River, and we don't see near as much on the other end of the Kansas River. I hope it never moves out to the other end. If you go on the Kansas River from 435 Bridge, where Water One has their intake in Johnson County, all the way down to where it meets the Missouri River, there are no sandbars. There's not even much of a riparian zone. I mean, it just looks like these slick banks of mud as you go down the river. You get above the Water One intake and you start to see sandbars again. Sandbar holes, so we advocate that they move into the floodplain, and there is one dredger, Penny's Concrete, that moved into the floodplain, in fact, here in Douglas County. And if you look at the site that they used to have in the Kansas River, that's what changed how Mud Creek interacts with the Kansas River. So there was a dredge hole there, and it's usually, I think, about 40 feet deep that they dredge the hole. And so what do you think happens when you have a hole in the middle of a river? It has to fill it, right? And so it pulls it from the banks. So you end up with bank collapse. The river will change its course, and that's what happened at Mud Creek. There used to be that the channel went pretty straight, and Mud Creek was off. You know, you guys know where Mud Creek is here in Lawrence on the bike trail. You could go right around the river, and there was a kind of a bend right there at Mud Creek where Mud Creek came in. And after that dredge hole was put in, it cut a new course. And so it cut off and left this island, and it basically cut off Mud Creek. Right now, if you go down there, I think it's about this wide, the trickle of Mud Creek down to the Kansas River, and it goes right along a big, huge sandbar. I mean, you can almost walk all the way out there. And I know it was pretty controversial, but the city of Lawrence shut down that boat ramp on Mud Creek because you can't use it. It's just a huge mud area, and it's cut off, one of our board members is a fluvial geomorphologist, and we've had lots of discussions about this, and it's all caused by the dredge hole. So we've seen huge changes in the Kansas River from that.
Wow, that was a...
Did that answer both
questions? That was a great question.
Okay.
Next one is for whoever wants to take it. I'll take the mic, that way I can just pass it around. How to discourage fence row cropping, leaving only feet of riparian habitat. Anybody have any answer to that? You don't have to. How do we discourage fence row to fence row cropping? I think somebody asked a question.
One thing we can have is to address the Farm Bill. And you've got to have rewards and incentives for farmers to increase that area between the bank and to increase the riparian areas. And right now the Farm Bill is really not doing that. And so how do we address that? That's a tough one. That's really tough because the farmers are just hanging on in so many ways, like it or not, financially. And so they want to get all the acreage they can. And so that means pushing up and pushing up and pushing up until you get a narrow, narrow band. I don't think it's going to happen by voluntary, although some will do that. But it's going to have to take some regulatory action, most likely by the state because the National Farm Bill, it's unlikely we're going to get it. We're certainly not going to get much help, frankly, from Senator Roberts, although Moran is on another committee and might be helpful at that point. Oh.
Can I add to that?
Go for it. Thank you. Now, the next question, what can urban residents do to improve water quality and reduce nutrient pollution and runoff? Rachel, you want to try that one?
Sure.
I'll put you on the spot because I know you're fast on your feet.
Well, I was doing a little bit of reading about this, and some of the things include not using weed killer in your front yard if you can avoid it. Also, if you're like washing your car, taking it to a car wash or washing it in a place where it's not going to run off into the street, I think are some of the things I read about as far as that's concerned. And just general water conservation, you know, you don't leave your water running when you're brushing your teeth and stuff like that. I think in the end,
thank you.
What would be most helpful is just more education. If people could become more aware of the effects that they have on their water and their local water sources, understand how the water gets to their house. But at the same time, I always hesitate when I advocate education because, in a lot of ways, that's a privilege and a luxury. You know, I don't think there's any one solution to it. I think sometimes there's this like false antagonistic relationship between jobs and the environment. And I think we have to just work as hard as possible to dispel that notion.
Thank you, Rachel. We're going to start taking questions from the floor, and Steve Mann has one.
I actually don't have a question. I have a solution for that problem. It's called Grow Food, Not Lawns.
Yay.
Yeah, I think that's true, but I think that that also is a luxury. I think there's a lot of people who, you know, are low income, who are working several jobs, who possibly are not able to grow their own food or invest like in that type of urban agriculture. So I think we have to be careful when we like make blanket statements like solutions like that, that we are not, you know, we may have the luxury, I have the luxury to be here tonight and everything like that, and we have to be careful about just blanket solutions.
Questions from the floor? Who'd like to jump in? Raise your hand. Okay, right here in the front. Yeah, there's a microphone right here. You can here. In fact, I'll bring it to you. You don't have to get up. If I can figure out how to get it out. Yes.
So I just heard, this is working, yeah. I'm hearing a lot of solutions in terms of like sort of individual, like eat less meat, but I'm wondering, you were the first one that brought this up. I'm wondering about the opportunity we have to disrupt economic ties between, catering in like K-12 schools, hospitals and prisons where they have contracts with like Aramark, Sodexo, Compass Group, who contract with groups like Tyson to fulfill quotas of meat production. And so even if we all stopped eating meat, you know, they would still have these quotas to fulfill. They would still be producing and selling and trying to sell this much meat, and Tyson would still be happy. And so how do we, you know, as one way to reduce meat production. How do we disrupt that stream of the economy?
Well, I didn't say it would be easy. No, that's a very good point. This institutionalization of this dreadful industrial food system we have. But I think in many urban areas, through groups like us or other what I would call progressives, have started to encourage schools to have gardens and start produce some of their own vegetables, and which teaches children that veggies are very important. And there's also a problem with public budgets, because that's why they do business with the United Foods of the world. They bring in stuff in trucks. But I think if you look where we are now compared to 20 years ago, you're seeing a lot more, I think, forward-looking food policy in our cities, not at the state level so much because they're tied up with big ag, but politics. So I think it's just local community action, encouraging your schools to buy local, for example, buy local and organic. There are more and more farmers in Kansas City. We have numerous groups now, the Cultivate KC, the Kansas City Food Circle. And so we're making progress. It's going to take time, but I've seen a lot in the last 20 years. Anybody else want to?
I think that, again, it's really important to do the individual actions. I don't have an argument with that, but we've got to get the systemic issues. We've really got to address them. Those are tough ones, and they take a sense of who do we talk to in the legislature, who do we talk to in our city commissions, who do we talk to in our county commissions, how do we do that in a way that's articulate, where do our friends are to do that. There's got to be a strategy, I think, as we go along and do that. Otherwise, we may feel good, and we certainly need to do the individual actions, but we don't join that with a systemic analysis in some way. Now, we can think of different ways than that. For example, again, you know, in the 2018 Farm Bill, what are the crops that are being promoted? They're water-consuming crops. How do we go in other directions? How can we change that systemic aspect from an agricultural bill? That's why hemp is really important in terms of decreasing the use of water, for example, and looking at it. So are decreasing the use of corn, which is now, they subsidize that so much. So it's just a principle of systemic, which is tough, I think, but we've got to begin getting more at that to root of what the issues are, as well as the individual actions. So.
I just wanted to mention that the Friends of the Earth has a 72-page manual on how to go about making that happen in a more systemic way with municipalities and other groups.
That's it.
You know, the question would be, how much of that is applicable here?
I'll do it from now on. Okay.
Well, basically, you're saying we need to educate and really focus on the education along with all this. We're getting people at all levels. I can't agree with you more. That's a systemic issue in a curriculum. That needs to be. I also think we need to start the churches, get with it, the faith communities. This is a matter of a theological crisis that's going on. I can speak to that. I come out of a faith community. The church, faith communities, not just Christian, but others, are not about personal salvation. It's about the earth. And we're a part of that web of life that is sacred. So that is an important systemic thing to address, and that's a hot issue, but it needs to be done. Let me put you, it'll be a hot item. Can we civilly talk about population? It's okay. Can we, though? It's the numbers, but it's consumption. We need to have ways of talking about that, because right now it's either for, against, and all those kinds. Those are kinds of hard issues for water and for the general earth environment. Well, I got off the subject. Sorry. Okay.
Another question, please.
Two questions. One that kind of tags along the end of what you said, Thad. But first, I just have a question about like the logistics of in the operations, as far as like when it comes to tracking water systems, sewage systems. Do you have a lot of effective resources, visual materials like maps and flow charts and things that might accompany other cogent information for when we campaign and outreach? And my second point, I guess, is I guess I'll save it, but it does have to do with messaging and about how we talk about the environment as if the earth needs to be saved. Just a reminder, the earth is going to outlive us. So it's, but in our non-indigenous dominated worldview, Judeo-Christians dominate, you know, they make up a majority of this country, of this culture. I mean, people are never going to be convinced that the earth is a spiritual being. I think it's really important to figure out how to talk about it in a way that recognizes that it's about saving us, you know. And so I'm done.
Okay, I'll try to be quick on that. On the second one, that is a big issue about it. It isn't just us, but us as a part of all. So how do we do that in terms of the faith community? The other is, I got it, and I'll be glad to send it to you. This is a PowerPoint that came out of our last presentation, the Kansas River, how bad is it really, and how much better can we make it? And this was put up by Tom Stiles. We have excellent people at the state level in this state who have the expertise, the maps, and everything. Money, they don't have in a lot of ways. Research needed, not enough money. Again, that's another area that we need to advocate for, because these are folks that are good people that are trying to do their best, and yet they don't have the resources.
Hi. Usually this time of year, excuse me, usually this time of year, roads, municipalities resort to salt and sand on the roads for road safety. I'm wondering if folks could comment on what that does to water in our area.
It's bad for the river.
any alternatives?
I only know what I've read, like about using, is it beet juice? I've heard some communities use beet juice. They spray it all over the roads, and so you have this bright red color. But it's much more, much better for the river and for the environment. So we haven't seen any of that used in our area, in our urban areas. I do occasionally send stuff out through Friends of the Call talking about it, just to kind of keep it at the forefront of people's minds that, you know, here we are salting, but it is going to all wash into the Kansas River. And just a reminder, 800,000 people get their drinking water from the Kansas River.
Hi, is it working? Okay, I'm out of experience with these things. I just wanted to take this opportunity to thank Jessica Schofield with Kansas Water, because her creating the, I think in conjunction with some other people, the Kansas Water really brought to my attention what's happening with these wastewater injection wells and the fracking wells. And I see that you're doing tireless work. I was just looking at the Kansas Corporation Commission docket for the Hadle and Thrasher injection well here south of Eudora. The hearing is February 22nd. And I noticed that you uploaded some documents that are now a matter of public record. And I think that I'm grateful to the Cindy Hodel and the folks that are working with the Kansas Legislature to change some things, and the Kansas Corporation Commission should not be monitoring these permits, period. In the meantime, this whole Hadle Thrasher well here locally has just got me on pins and needles. All these water issues are so important, but this has potential to have catastrophic effects in our area, so it's really important to me. So right now, as we're waiting for this, I think it's a pre-hearing on the 22nd, my question for you is two things. People who were not added as protestants to the docket, what can they do to support to speak out against this particular permit, or to how would they get tied in with the people who are working with the Kansas Legislature? Like, I don't even know how to get in touch with someone who's these people who are working to change things at the state level. So I have another question, but I'll start with that.
How could they get involved with the
if they're not as a protestant officially on the docket for the Hadle and Thrasher, which are the ones here in Douglas County. If we're going to, once the hearing is set for the date, I mean, I'm thinking that we'll have like a action, direct action type event at the KCC, like we've had in the past, but I would like it to be more people and greater media to bring more attention to it, you know, obviously peaceful and all that. So that's one way I'm thinking that people could get involved. The Douglas County, Karen actually was super helpful at getting the Douglas County commissioners and city council people to also voice their concerns about it. So continued Douglas County residents could continue to contact them to kind of work through them and let them know their concerns. You could also contact Kansas, your legislatures, you know, your local like Boog, Heiberger and stuff like that. If you don't have Cindy's, so Cindy and Joe Spies are the people working with the legislature, and I'm not sure how like hush-hush that's all supposed to be, but they're working specifically on induced seismicity because they think that's more of a way to get bipartisan support of the bill because infrastructure, you know, people think, oh, well, Republicans and Democrats can get behind infrastructure damage money. So that's not really a water focus, what they're doing right now. I did email the Water and Environment Committee. Tom Sloan's the chair of that last week with a big long letter and all this stuff. So if people maybe wanted to contact Tom Sloan in like solidarity saying like, yeah, we don't like these either, maybe that would help because they're supposed, I've talked to my local representation, Barbara Baliakes. I live in Johnson County. And she's just like, well, I'm just waiting to see what they do. So,
do you want to add anything?
Well, I'm on the docket on that as well, and I'm not quite. I'm not a water expert, or a hydrologist, or a geologist, or anything you would think would be useful. What I thought I might do is just ask for a Kansas Open Records request and ask anyone who wrote a letter of protest to get those documents and ask those people if they would actually like to be called as witnesses. I'm not sure that's going to work, but that's one idea I had of letting more people voice their dissent. So. Open to more ideas.
Any more questions? Please come to the mic so we can make sure we get it on the radio.
I just wanted to follow up on that just real fast.
Would you come up here, please? I'm sorry.
I'm going to come and I forget what I just said. What was the last thing you were just talking about? Because
Records request. The KCC on their website says we value your opinion.
Right.
But they really seem to do everything to shut out public opinion on the matters that they're supposedly in charge of. So I'm trying to think of ways of how to get more voices heard.
Thank you. That sparked again what just occurred to me. I was at the hearing, as I think we spoke yesterday, at a different location. And I'm not familiar with all of the exact location of the one in Eudora, but the one yesterday, the three protestants, two of them lived really, really close to the site. And I assume that that's in your thinking to find people who are close. And is that within your ability to do that? How does that work? I don't know, but it was very effective. Mm-hmm. And I would suggest that in the future. And that may be like a nonsense, simple thing to say, but it was very effective.
Okay, thank you. Thanks.
Great conversation. Thank you, everybody. More questions?
Yeah.
Go. Oh, we have a line. Let's go. Thank you.
Howdy, y'all. I kind of have a more out there question, but
definitely still relates to water. In terms of farmers, there's basically two types that we think of. You have the big industrialized monocropists that use, you know, soybeans, wheat, or corn, and then you've got the more homey feel organic farmers. And both have the same similar needs, fertilizer, sunlight, and water being a big one. And it seems a lot of times that when you try to get both groups to interact with each other, there's conflict. And you see that with a lot of different environmental groups. There's always the environmentalists, the good guys, and the corporations or people along that nature, the bad guys. And I'm just kind of wondering, while I have a large group of intelligent people at my disposal, if any of you have any comments or thoughts on how to bridge the gap between industrialized monocropists and local organic farmers.
I can't speak to that directly, but I attended the fourth annual Moving Forward Network conference in California, and it was really interesting because there was a lot of talk about port authorities, right, and air pollution. And one of the most successful things that I think came out of the conference was their ability to work with workers in the port to advocate for better working conditions, which in turn turned into better environmental standards and better environmental conditions. So I think that looking at it from a standpoint of class and the proletariat is probably a good way to go.
Thank you.
Okay. Sir, you're up.
So my question's for Jessica. And so, Jessica, you and I were in protesting the quail oil injection or disposal well in Morris County. And so I did a little more work on that permit, and there are not really very many producing wells in Morris County, which leads me to believe that the produced waters which are coming into Morris County, and I think that quail oil permit was for 5,000 barrels a day to be disposed. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So my question is, do you know whether or not produced waters, which are saline solutions, which come back up out of an injection well, do you know if produced waters are being brought into Kansas? And if so, then Kansas would be sort of the waste barrel for other states. So are produced waters coming into Kansas, say from Oklahoma, and are produced waters coming from other counties, say like Sumner and Harper, up to Morris? That's my question.
So I don't know for sure. I don't know how to look that information up or figure that out. The fact that we only produce 1% of the country's oil and gas, but yet we have 10% of the wells, does lead me to believe that we are. Because Oklahoma, once they started after their Pawnee quake, they really tightened regulations on their fracking wastewater injections. And then kind of right after that, we started having the higher induced seismicity events in Sumner and Harper counties, as in maybe it was getting trucked over. There, I have no proof of that, though, and I don't know how to find that information. But it is kind of fishy. I have heard rumors, but, you know, I can't verify that. And as far as your question to the Morris County well specifically, the whole goal of these UIC wells is supposed to be that they're one of the benefits. There's really no benefit, but if you talk to the people asking for these things, the benefit is that they don't have to truck the waste very far, and that's better because then it's not on the roads, et cetera, et cetera. But you're right that there's not any producing or not many producing wells near there. So again, I don't know that the waste is getting trucked in from elsewhere, but it seems that way.
I'd like to briefly address that question. That's a great question because
Since the topic came up, I've been kind of surfing different websites, particularly industrial websites. And what I found is that when they're talking among themselves about wastewater injection, whatever, they say, well, this is how you go about it. And, you know, if you're planning on bringing it from offsite, blah, 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 you know, it's part of their discussion. They're getting wells so they can bring it from offsite and dispose of it from elsewhere. You know, it's not an assumption, it's a given. The question, I think, is how can we address the regulations at the KCC so that we know if that is happening and how to keep it from happening?
We're down to the last 5 minutes of the Q&A. We have one topic we want to talk about. Upcoming legislation, this is breaking news, upcoming legislation in the state of Kansas. Okay. Turn the mic over to you, guys.
Yeah, this is a heads up. A bill was just introduced yesterday, I think, and we're calling it the Tyson Bill. Most people don't know this, but aside from the spontaneous revolt in Tonganoxie, Tyson was also upset because they found out that for the huge number of chickens they wanted to put in each site, this is production sites, that they would need a federal permit and have a separation distance to the nearest neighbor of 4,000 feet. And they're used to having much smaller separation distances in the southern states they've been using. So they asked KDHE to weaken the rules to much reduce the separation distance, and a bill was just introduced to do that. It'll be introduced in another day or two in the House. There was a presentation by a so-called poultry expert from K-State yesterday on that. So I'm just asking you to be on the alert to hear about when to contact your senators and representatives. There'll probably be a hearing on this in about 2 weeks, and a number of the groups are aware of it and working on it. Do you want to add to that, Don?
We need a grassroots opposition to this, and that's going to take all of us. Basically, what we're hearing is that this will open up the doors for Kansas to become a poultry state. And right now we have very little poultry in the state, and we're really concerned about this. This is going to have a huge impact on lots of things: water quality, air quality, our quality of life, the way that we live and breathe. And so I ask that you pay attention to the legislature and what's happening. They're introducing legislation. There was another bill introduced yesterday by Senator Holland and Representative, I always mess his name up, Carl Sink. He's the representative from Tonganoxie. And they introduced a bill into both the House and the Senate where they're asking for communities to be able to have the ability to make the decision about whether or not a poultry production facility comes to their community. And this is all in response to Tonganoxie, of course, but we should all have the right to decide whether or not this comes to our town. And they think they're going to have bipartisan support because they're saying, you know, if a community wants it, then that's that community's decision. But if they don't, that's their decision too. And that they shouldn't be allowed to bring these things in under the cover of darkness and that no one knows about it. And that's what happened in Tonganoxie. I mean, absolutely no one knew that it was coming except for the people at the Department of Ag. So there's those two bills that are going to make their way through, and they'll have hearings on them. So if you're concerned about them, contact your legislator. They've got email addresses. Send them an email and just say, you know, I'm not in support of this, or I am in support of this. Thank you.
We are.
Thank you very much. That was a great ending. Great questions. Oh, I'm sorry. One more question.
I just wanted to add on to what you were saying. So my name is Makokwa Abigail Jones. I work for the Prairie Band Potawatomi Nation up in Mayetta. I'm their environmental technician dealing with non-point source pollution issues in our watershed. One of the places that kind of threw their hat in the ring to get this poultry plant was Holton and Horton areas, and the community seemed to be backing that. But the tribes strongly oppose this poultry plant to go through there, and that directly impacts our water, where we have water rights. We have, rights to our water, and that's our drinking water sources. And so it becomes an environmental issue for an environmental justice issue for us, because oftentimes it's our communities that get put on the back burner for these larger communities that want the jobs, that want the economy and stuff. But, we could use that support as tribes, at that environmental justice level to stand with us and say, no, we don't want these poultry plants contaminating our already contaminated water that we work on very minimal resources to try and clean up and restore. And so that's another aspect of this poultry plant, that they're looking for areas like that where the community supports it. But not all these communities support it, but we don't often get our voices heard at the tribal level. So.
Great point. Thank you.
We're going to take a break now for 10 or 15 minutes. When you guys get up, could you push some tables together? So there's two tables back to back. We're going to break into groups, but think about what group you want to be in. We thought of some while the presenters were talking. Maybe Kansas River, Corporate Ag, Oil and Gas, Urban Water, or maybe a legislative advocacy group. Think about what you want to do, but help by pushing a couple tables together if you could. And take a little break. We'll start up at about 8:30.